Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
This is Dr. Peter Bregan. I am a psychiatrist. And I have a marvelous professor of psychology on with me today. His name is Robert Niemeyer, N-E-I-M-E-Y-E-R. He's from University of Memphis. I met him in Arizona at a bereavement conference put on by our mutual friend, Joanne Cacciatore. This is a very apt time to have Bob Niemeyer on. The American Psychiatric Association, in all its perverse wisdom, has recently determined that it will approve the DSM-5 that comes out in May, which has in it a new approach to bereavement, making it a mental disorder after 2 weeks' duration. So if you've lost the love of your life, you get 2 weeks before you need a psychiatric intervention. Bob is a remarkable man. He's written 25 books, which is fun. That's generally the number I cite for myself. And he's written a lot more scientific articles. His new book is Techniques of Grief Therapy. And the subtitle is Creative Practices for Counseling the Bereaved. Bob is a gentle and kind man. Are you there, Bob?
Indeed I am, Peter, and I appreciate the perhaps overly generous praise that you're giving me.
Well, I wanted to continue with it a little bit more, but I want to also check in because we've had some glitches and make sure you were indeed there. One of the things you folks will be struck by, I think, as Bob talks, is that he's also a clinician. He works with people, and he's got that healing aura about him that I think will be communicated on the radio. Bob, where would you like to begin? Anywhere you like, really.
Well, you know, Peter, you've raised an issue that probably not only fascinates and concerns the two of us, but is likely to concern people who are listening as well, and that is the whole notion of what do we mean by grief? Do we understand it in predominantly psychiatric, psychological terms? Do we see it as a fundamental human experience? And what happens when grief doesn't go well? How do we understand the complexities of what people contend with? So the fact that the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, just as you point out, has now removed what's called the bereavement exclusion, meaning that for many years, psychiatrists have agreed with many bereaved people themselves that grief is a fundamentally normal human experience. And so it should not be treated as major depressive disorder that requires some kind of intervention and probably of a pharmacological kind, that is, in terms of psychiatric medication. But with the removal of this exclusion, saying that now, within 2 weeks of the death of a loved one, one can diagnose and treat depression, it does raise the concern that pharmacological response to this essentially human condition will be legitimated, even encouraged, in a way that may actually block people from receiving other kinds of attention from their own families, communities, or other providers who would not be moved to respond to loss with a pill. So that's one topic that we might talk a little bit about is how do we understand depression or grief, and what proper role might psychiatry and psychology have in responding to it?
Well, I think it's a good one to continue to go into. I have a couple of ideas about why they insisted on doing this, despite a very organized effort led in part by our friend Joanne Cacciatore. And I think you were involved in it too, weren't you, to let the APA know?
Yes, I didn't play the organized or organizing role that Joanne, who is a prominent social worker, did. But I certainly had and have my misgivings about the decision. I didn't make a secret of those.
So the question is, why do they want to push this? I have two thoughts about it, and I might be interested to get yours, too. I think, one, it's simply that, of course, so many people on the DSM committee have connections to the drug companies.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to just increase as much as possible, what they do for their patrons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other issue is that if bereavement is not a disorder, then are there any disorders? To which I would answer no, not in the sense of the American Psychiatric Association. When a person gets depressed, there's always something going on inside that person.
Yeah.
Something from childhood, something from current times, a frustration, sometimes dealing with age, sometimes dealing with drug abuse, sometimes dealing with illness. I mean, there's just so many of these causes that go in to people falling into despair, despondency, apathy, mm-hmm. and so on, that bereavement is just one. So if they could give a pass to the bereaved and say, you're not ill, you don't need to be drugged, they have to give a pass to everybody and acknowledge that this whole thing is false. Do you think that's possible?
I think that's a provocative view, an interesting one, and I like the idea of holding that as a counterpoint to the idea that a huge swath of the American public requires professional intervention for what are essentially normative life transitions, as you imply. Now, I do think, it just to give the devil his due, it is interesting if we were to say that if we are to lose our job and become depressed, that we can understand that in psychiatric terms, or that if we lose our abilities or we're injured or we contract a serious illness and are depressed, that if we acknowledge that those are treatable conditions, whether with psychotherapy or psychopharmacology, then it is, in a way, ironic to say that the loss of a loved one uniquely does not warrant the designation of depression. And this is part of the rationale used by those who justify this, the inclusion of this depressive diagnosis in the wake of bereavement. But I think that the more informed view, in my estimation, is to think about what is grief? How do we understand grief? And how do we not simply assimilate it into a general category of feeling bad, of losing motivation, of having disrupted sleep, of finding it difficult to experience pleasure, all of these cardinal symptoms of depression? But if we ask ourselves, what is unique about the experience of bereavement, that kind of yearning for this now lost attachment to another, the kind of separation anxiety and insecurity that we feel upon losing a person who is part of our secure base in the world, part of our rootedness in the world. These kinds of attachment-related issues are arguably distinctive to grief, and they differentiate it from a kind of garden variety depression. And the evidence is pretty good scientifically that it calls for a different response, that it, if treatment is indicated when grief becomes so severe, so debilitating, so prolonged, that it's really compromising across a half year, year, 2 years or more, a person's ability to manage other relationships and life responsibilities, then there probably is a role for therapy. But it doesn't seem to be primarily a pharmacotherapy. It seems to be more an attuned psychological counseling that tends to have the evidence base in its favor, that what we need is a human relationship in order to deal with the loss of a human relationship.
Bob, we're going to take an earlier break. I'm very much with what you're saying. I think it's very important. We're going to take an earlier break and see if we can improve a bit on the sound of your incoming call, which is okay, but I want people to hear that marvelous voice a little better than we're doing.
All right.
So when we're ready in the studio, you'll hear some music break in, and they're going to get in touch with you.
Okay, that sounds good. Shall I hang up then, Peter?
Yeah, I think you should hang up, and we'll go on to break now.
Okay.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. My guest is Robert Niemeyer. We've been having a little connection problems from Bob's side of the world, and we're going to see if we can fix them up. One of the nice credentials I forgot to mention for Bob is that he's a new member of the advisory council of our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. And for those of you looking for therapists, or those of you who are listening and who are therapists or involved with therapeutic organizations, just a reminder that we have a new resource center on empathictherapy.org. So go to empathictherapy.org and look down the index on the side, and you'll find that we have lists of folks who lend their name to our kind of work, and you can look them up and check them out and see if they might be able to provide you with some help. Now, I don't know, am I connected with Bob? Bob Niemeyer, are you there?
I am indeed, Peter, and I wonder if you have a better connection with me now.
Yeah, I think it sounds a little better.
All right, I've got great phones, so we'll see if my iPhone does a better job than my house phone.
Okay. As we were finishing and going to break in order to try to check out your equipment, you were saying that you really do think bereavement belongs in a separate category, which is, I think, going to be somewhat of a difference of opinion, although we would end up in the same place, which is that the bereaved need caring, sensitive counseling, as do, I think, all people who are depressed, should they choose the counseling route.
Yes.
There are many other routes, religion,
yes,
philosophy, love, family life, and so on. But I'd like you to continue with your thoughts about it.
Well, I'm not wanting to claim a unique province for professionals in this regard. In fact, what our research on the impact of grief therapy suggests is the case for humility on the part of professionals, and also the case for hope on the part of the bereaved themselves, because what we discover is that across 62 randomized controlled studies of grief therapy compared to an alternative form of treatment or a waitlist condition, what we find is that most of the bereaved don't benefit from grief therapy, because grief isn't a disorder. And the people who suffer loss, which certainly includes both of us and most of our listeners, usually manage with a fair degree of resilience. Human beings have the capacity to confront difficult circumstances and surmount them. We do it on the basis of our own resources, the resources of our families, communities, state traditions sometimes, personal philosophies. So that really professional intervention is indicated only when we're not able to engage in this kind of self-righting, resilient response after a reasonable period of time. And my personal view is that some of the descriptions of complicated grief, the ways in which grief can become very protracted and disabling, are legitimate,
as descriptions of the experience of approximately 10% of bereaved people. The other 90% or so probably don't require much by way of professional care. What they require is understanding on the part of their family and opportunities to mourn the loss, to kind of rebuild a symbolic connection with the loved one, one might say a spiritual or a psychological connection instead of a physical sense of the other's presence in our lives. And this doesn't necessarily require psychiatric or psychological care, except when it does. And I think, again, for a minority of people who struggle greatly with loss across an extended period of time and seem only to be increasingly disengaged from their lives, deeply unhappy, disempowered, and potentially even at the point of suicide, then professional assistance is warranted. And I would do no better in describing what's required there than to invoke the term of empathic therapy, regardless of the discipline of the person who is offering it, as the core of what is required. Then there are specialized methods and techniques that can help us in our work as therapists, but it all begins with personal presence and empathic concern.
What's tormenting, or what can't people let go of? What are folks struggling with who just can't get back fully to their lives after a loss?
I don't think there's a single response to that, because there's not a single kind of relationship that we lose and a single circumstance under which we lose those we loved. So when the circumstances of death, for example, are traumatizing, and a loved one, like in the case of my family, my father, ends his life in suicide, or when, as is the case with some of my clients, a loved one is abducted, murdered, shot, perhaps in a home entry situation, when we experience the sudden and traumatizing news that our child has been killed driving back to college after a holiday break, these sorts of deaths are themselves assaults on what we might call our assumptive world, the world view that somehow life is predictable, that justice will prevail, that we have the power to protect those we love from adversity. And all of these assumptions and more may be cruelly undercut by these forms of traumatizing death. But I think as well, the character of the relationship we lose, even if the death comes by way of natural causes, such as prolonged illness, can still greatly challenge us. When we lose a parent or a spouse, one neuron at a time to Alzheimer's, or one breath at a time to emphysema, or through a gradual or a roller coaster of experiences associated with recurrent cancer and its treatment, all of these can provide huge challenges for us in our adaptation. And then sometimes the nature of the relationship, as in the duty of care that we feel toward a child, and we experience the death of a child, or the kind of life-defining connection to a partner of many years, to suddenly be uprooted from that relationship. All of these things can pose profound challenges that we have a hard time wrapping our hearts and minds around. And in extreme cases, we may find ourselves unable to do so without the special assistance that sometimes a caring professional who has been there in that situation with many others who've suffered similar losses can provide.
One of the things that I find occasionally, excuse me, when people are having difficulty getting over a lot of just self-defeating, painful, demoralizing feelings after the death of a parent, mm-hmm. is that they're actually ambivalent about that parent, feel that they never got the love they needed, and now there's no more chance of that, and so they have an irrevocable loss of something they never had but had hoped for, and then also they're then dealing not just with loss, but with anger and disappointment at how they were treated by the parent and so on. And
yeah.
I think that complicates some of the folks that I see on occasion.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that in one way of thinking about it, we have two sorts of narrative challenges in bereavement. And what I mean by that is we have a hard time often wrapping our hearts and minds around the story of the death itself, especially when the death was sudden, unexplained, or a function of human intention, such as suicide or homicide deaths. So in that case, the death story is a real problem for us to take in, acknowledge, find a way of holding without being traumatized by it. And then we also have to, at times, work on accessing and dealing with the backstory of our relationship with our loved one. And just as you point out, that backstory can be filled with ambivalence, disappointment, anger, as well as love and unmet need. And so I find myself in grief therapy dealing with both of these things with some frequency, helping people speak, acknowledge, find some way to make sense of the death, and also make sense of their life now in light of the loss, and then also to work on the relationship with the dead. And I think this is one of an interesting dimension of contemporary bereavement work, is the recognition that the goal of grieving is not to let go. It's not to simply move on and leave the loved one behind, but the goal of grieving is in some sense to rework our connection or emotional bond to the deceased in a way that lets us maintain the bond, but in another form, a form that is sustainable without their physical presence at the breakfast table or in our bedroom. And that, I think, it's a profound challenge. It's one that many of the bereaved meet on their own spontaneously, but sometimes people can use some special assistance with that.
I love the way you talk about your work, and I think the idea of narrative and story that the person evolves about themselves is so important. And I love the concept of backstory. I've never heard it used that way, and I just think it's really a worthwhile way to look at things. One of the issues that you and I met surrounding with Joanne Cacciatore's organization, which is named MISS, M-I-S-S, for those of you who want to check her out. She's been on the show in the past and will be on the show again. You can find her in the archives. Is the special trauma of the loss of a child.
Yeah.
And that was just so brought home by that conference, because here were hundreds of people who had lost children in the extreme. I think one individual lost three children in a fire, young children.
Yes.
And the notion there that there's no hurrying this recovery, and that there may not be recovery in the usual sense. I'd love to hear your ideas about traumatic loss of children, this unexpected, sudden, horrific loss of children. Why it seems to be, and if you agree it is, just about the most difficult loss to move on from, and just your thoughts about it.
Well, of course, I am a parent. However, I do speak from a position of humility here. I have not myself lost a child, and so I'm informed by the experiences of friends and especially many clients who have suffered something that I have not, at least yet, had to take on board. So with that caveat, that I am an interested outsider and companion to those who are on the inside of an experience, I guess I draw attention to the way in which in many forms of loss, what we lose is a kind of attachment bond with someone who provides security for us. Classically, of course, this may be a parent, especially if the parent has been a good one and given us a kind of loving and supportive container for living, especially during our childhood. We pick up that sense of security, that conviction that people are going to be there for us, that we're lovable, and we carry it into future relationships and build relationships on that ground. When we lose a child, though, it is less a matter of losing a security-enhancing relationship than it is in losing what John Bowlby, the famous psychiatrist, called a caregiving bond, where we have a duty of care to those we love and raise. We may extend that as well to a spouse or to others who are vulnerable and dependent on us, but our children are surely in that place. And our inability then to protect our children from the worst possible outcome in most of our minds, that being death, leaves us with a sense of powerlessness, a sense of failure, often a sense of self-accusation, guilt, and all of these sources of self-blame, disappointment not only with the loss, but disappointment with ourselves for being unable to prevent it. These can complicate our grieving, can't they? We also lose the future that was linked to that child, and the prospect of perhaps having that child bring us grandchildren. Our own life narrative, our own life story, is powerfully undercut by this cardinal loss. And so I think there are many dimensions to the loss of a child that greatly complicate our attempt to somehow adjust to it. Now, what I would say, too, is that, you know, you raise an interesting term here when you acknowledge that it's a very difficult loss to, quote, recover, unquote, from. And I'd kind of like to cast doubt on the idea that we do recover from it in the same way that we recover from an illness or some other adversity. I think that the grief experience around cardinal losses like these is a lifetime kind of thing. We live always with some accessible shadow of sadness that is at least available to us. We may not live, you know, in its darkest hues. We may find ways of adapting to living with some degree of grief. But I do think that the word adaptation to grief is probably more accurate than recovery from it. We learn how to live with grief and not have it become the entirety of our lives.
So I think it's very profound, Bob. I'm really with you on that. One of the thoughts that occurred to me at that conference, as I thought about my own life in terms of grief and loss, is that to some extent we all live in grief. You know, we lose our childhoods, yeah. We lose our connections, childlike connections to our family, and have to strike out on our own, even if they're alive, our parents. And then we all have rejections along the way, romantic rejections, loss of friends. And I think that grief is an integral part of life. And the way you talk about it really inspires me to think more in that direction, that we all are struggling with grief, and it becomes something that's relative and unique to each of us.
You know, you say that so well, Peter. I don't think I could phrase it better myself, that just the idea that ultimately every person, every place, every project, and every possession that we love, we will lose, at least in an earthly sense. And so how we learn the lessons of loss powerfully shape who we become as individuals, as families, as communities, as societies, as cultures. You know, loss, I'm a university professor as well as being a practicing psychologist, and so I think in curriculum terms, and I think of loss as part of the core curriculum of living. It's not an elective course. It's one that we have to take. It's one that we hope we can pass, and it's one that, for better or worse, we're likely to have to repeat. So the notion of learning the lessons of loss, of learning how to somehow negotiate this strange human terrain of being wired for attachment in a world of impermanence is just part of the human condition.
Absolutely, and I think that we struggle with it, to be a little simple-minded about it. We can handle the threat of loss, knowing that we can lose a loved one, knowing that we may not be able to stay in a place we love, knowing that we may lose anything we treasure. We can handle that by distancing ourselves from it, but we can also handle it by treasuring even more the life we have. And I think I try to do that with my own sense of the fragility of life, the potential for loss. I try, not always successfully, to have it motivate me to treasure even more what I'm enabled and allowed to do in this world and whom I'm able to be with and where I'm able to live and so on. Treasuring it.
I agree with you, and I think that that is an affirmative response that preserves the best of what we are capable of as human beings, to somehow love passionately the people, things, places that matter to us, and projects, but to do so in the recognition that it's not a forever arrangement. Again, at least in an earthly sense, it's a limited time offer, and so making the most of these moments, not allowing time to be squandered and frittered away with inconsequential activities and commitments, is, I think, it's a big part of living well. And when we get to the end of our lives, being able to look back and feel that we made, on average, good choices about who we were, who we loved, and what we did.
This is good. You know, the first time I met you, we sat down on that couch in a little corner of the hotel, and I just had this enormous sense of, how very thoughtful you are, but also just a comfort in being with you, that a lot of what I think and feel is shared by this other person. And that's really coming out on the show today. I mean, it's really just wonderful to have you here. And it would be lovely if people could come away from hearing us talk with some greater sense of just the flat-out importance of life and love and the complexities of dealing with it and whenever possible, coming back to treasuring. And there's something I would love you to address even more deeply, which you've mentioned a few times, which is the spiritual connection with those who are gone. This is a place where we can really talk about that kind of thing, which can't necessarily be talked about easily in many psychological venues. But on my show, I love to talk about God, spirituality, and all the connections. And, it's not about yourself, about the people you've worked with. What kinds of ways do you see people connecting spiritually with lost loved ones?
That's a great question, and it does invite deep and honest conversation of a kind that moves beyond our usual social conventions. And, of course, our social conventions, I should also hasten to say, can include some fairly cut-and-dry consolation that can be provided in a religious way, that doesn't provide much by way of sustenance or help for the bereaved. When someone loses a child and a well-intentioned friend says, well, God just needed another flower in his garden, or this is his way of testing your faith, or God never gives you more than you can handle, most of the bereaved I work with don't find that to be sustaining consolation. They see it as coming from a place of almost spiritual arrogance, or at best, a well-intentioned effort that miscarries. So what I would like to acknowledge here with you is what I find in my consulting room and in our research, as we focus our research efforts as well on people's ability to make meaning of the loss, often but not exclusively in spiritual terms. What we find is that spirituality or religion can be an ambivalent resource. It can give a great deal, but it can also pose its own challenges and problems. So I might just acknowledge a few of those before exploring some of the affirmative role of spirituality. What we find, for example, is that for a subset of people in our studies, and many of these studies have looked at folks here in the Mid-South in Memphis, Tennessee. This is kind of the buckle of the Bible Belt in some ways. So it's a predominantly Christian kind of frame. And many of the people then have held for a lifetime a view of spirituality that emphasizes a personal relationship with God, so that they may feel a kind of personal betrayal from God when their loved one dies, particularly under traumatic circumstances. And it can raise troubling spiritual questions and struggles for them about whether God permitted this tragic death because he didn't have the power to do otherwise, if he permitted it even as a form of potential punishment of the bereaved for some of their own wrongdoing in life, or whether he simply was not paying much attention. And we have a God who isn't terribly involved in our lives. All of these are possibilities that people struggle with when they experience a kind of spiritual crisis in their grieving. And the grieving is complicated, protracted. They search for spiritual meaning and have a hard time discerning it. Now, that's a subset, and probably only about a quarter of those who are contending with difficult losses. For many others, of course, their faith, whether Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, or another variety, is a source of great comfort to them. And there I see my clients routinely finding a sense of meaning in, for example, the hope of reunion, reconnection with their loved ones in a kind of afterlife, discerning the spiritual presence of their children, loved ones, parents in their lives, cultivating a kind of bond with them where they feel as if they can speak and address their concerns and feelings to their loved one and have the sense that in some way the other hears them and might even answer them in some small quiet voice within them. They can almost hear the loved one's response. All of these can be very affirmative and comforting uses of spirituality, though they are not the only possibilities. So I've also worked alongside Buddhists, for example, who don't have this same personalized view of God or relationships with our deceased loved ones, but who find that the spiritual concepts of suffering and in some way the recognition of impermanence in life, these fundamental kind of Buddhist precepts, provide them a mindful way of engaging their grief without being entirely captured by it. And they find a kind of spiritual discernment that is itself centering. So I think that there's no single answer to the role of what spirituality can do for us in our grieving. But what we do find is that often those who are able to respond in a more spiritually rich and sustaining way are also those who report the least post-traumatic stress following a death and the greatest post-traumatic growth, by which I mean a kind of reordering of their priorities and reinvestment in living and relationships with other people, a kind of experiencing greater compassion for others suffering and so on. So I think that spirituality can play many roles, fostering not only our own comfort, but also our own growth after grief.
Do you find that some people enter into a world that others might dismiss as psychotic, which gives them some comfort or provides them some function where they will actually be in the presence of, see, feel as real a lost loved one, hear the lost loved one's voice, if not see them, in a way that is real to them.
Yeah.
And I'd love you to talk a little about that.
Yeah, and in this, it certainly accords with my own experience that people frequently sense the presence of their loved ones in a way that could be misunderstood as a kind of psychiatric hallucination, and could be seen as a kind of psychotic response. But research is actually pretty consistent on this, Peter, that whether you look at the work of people like Sid Zissook, who have examined the experience of bereaved spouses and documented that 67% of them over a year following the death of their spouse will report experiencing the presence of their deceased spouse, maybe lying beside them on the bed at night or sensing their presence in their favorite reading chair or being able to carry out a kind of inner dialogue with the loved one or smelling that person's perfume or feeling their touch. So in many sensory domains, auditory, visual, tactile, even olfactory in terms of smelling, people may report the experience of the dead as if they were present, at least almost. Because if pressed, these same people who are reporting a sense of presence also acknowledge that, well, it's not exactly like they were physically there with me, but it was as if they were nearly. So I think that this suggests that what we might call reality testing, if we want to use that term, is still intact. They recognize that it's not as if the person has rematerialized and, you know, shown up at the dinner table, but they have a sense of a sustaining presence with the other, often nonspecific, but sometimes very concrete. We also know that about nearly 90% of the time, people experience this contact as comforting rather than something that produces anxiety or fear. Sometimes, of course, our relationships are less than ideal, as you were alluding to earlier. We can have very ambivalent, complex, or even abusive relationships with people who die. And then being, quote, visited, unquote, by them may not be a comforting thing. So, again, acknowledging the complexity of relationships, I would say the great majority of the time, this sense of contact is something that people experience as a benign, continuing bond rather than a worrisome psychiatric hallucination.
Do you ever see people pushed over into what we call a break with reality as a result of traumatic loss?
Sure.
I would think so. I'd love you to talk some about that, too.
Well, if we just think more generally, what is it in life that can break us? There are surely plenty of things in that category. Psychological trauma in all the forms that it can visit our lives can severely test our capacity to hold it together. And in some small but non-trivial percentage of cases, yes, a person can be broken by an experience of loss that they've really, especially if they've greatly counted on the other to provide this kind of secure base for their living, and then suddenly they've lost that. Particularly if in their own past they've had a sketchier sense of attachment. That is, maybe they've known what bad relationships are like, and then they finally get a really good one and lose that. Then I think that people can sometimes respond in a very disorganized, very panicky way that may have features that feel very out of control to them, that it's as if their personal reality is disintegrating. And some of this is captured by the concept of complicated grief, where we feel that a part of ourselves has irrevocably died with the other. We can't expect a future that makes any sense. It seems utterly bleached of meaning and purpose, and this kind of condition persists then potentially for years, with or without psychotic features.
Now, Bob, you know you know from meeting me and perhaps looking at my books that I don't start people on psychiatric drugs. What are your feelings? Maybe in about a 2 minutes, if you can do that concisely, what are your feelings about the use of psychiatric drugs in grief?
I'm very cautious about it as well. I'm not categorical in the sense that as a psychologist, I won't pretend to be a psychopharmacologist or a psychiatrist who might be better able to decide if there are cases in which the person might benefit from some medication. But what I do know from my practice, from the clients I work with, and also from the research literature, is that, for example, antidepressant medication does not address the core symptoms of grief that people often bring forward for help. We don't have a drug that will mitigate our separation anxiety. We won't have a drug that that somehow stops us from yearning for a love that has been lost, or feeling a deep sense of remorse or despair about the death of a child. And so I think in some ways, even if one were to acknowledge that pharmacology has a place, its place may not be centrally in dealing with grief. And the track record of psychiatric medication in dealing with grief is not very favorable.
We've got about a little more than 2 minutes. You just are such a rich source of knowledge, wisdom, information about bereavement and grief. What are some of the more trenchant lessons that you'd want to communicate to us?
Well, I think one basic thing to say to both providers and those who might seek psychological services is that people are pretty resilient. Let's ground ourselves in the reality of resilience to acknowledge people's considerable and often remarkable capacities to adapt to unwelcome change in our lives. We've evolved as a species to be pretty good at that. So let's begin with the assumption that professional and medical responses are not called for in the great majority of cases. Then let's be discerning about when they are. There are times that medicine or psychology can make a contribution when people do feel overwhelmed in the longer-term aftermath of a loss and require some assistance beyond what their family can give. And then let's be humble in partnering with our clients and discerning how can we be helpful to this person, drawing on the best of what we know about evidence-based practice, but also being informed by that person's discernment about what he or she needs in this moment in dealing with this loss. And
a
when
good,
we
a good summary, Bob. We're going to be leaving now. It's a wonderful summary. Robert Niemeyer, professor at the University of Memphis, a lovely human being, a very profound discussion. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Peter.